Rich Kimble and Kerry Haskell with you. We get on the telephone line right now to talk a little baseball. Welcome in our friend Sean McAdam from Boston Sports Journal. Sean, how are you this afternoon?
Baseball? What's that?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let's get to the really big and important news. Congratulations on a new addition to the family.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rich. We welcomed young Nolan to the family last weekend, and he's doing fine and got down to sneak a peek at him on Super Bowl Sunday and say hello and say hi to his big brother, who is doing all the things big brothers need to do to help out. So it's been a great week.
Well, that's exciting news indeed. Now, as for baseball, less exciting, where are we now?
I think it would be overly optimistic to say we're stuck in neutral. I think that actually some ground was lost today. A session that was convened at 1 o'clock in downtown New York lasted just 15 minutes. That in itself isn't necessarily alarming. It was the Players Association's turn to make a proposal. They did so and then didn't initiate any effort to negotiate on the spot, preferring to give the owners some time to consider what was proposed and then get back to them. But in the proposal, they actually expanded the number of people they want covered and eligible for arbitration, which is a non-starter for the owners, after coming down. I should amend that. Initially, they had looked to include anybody with 2 years plus of service time be eligible for arbitration. Currently, it's mostly players with 3 to 5 years, and then the top 22% among those with two plus. They had initially said they wanted all players with 2 years of service time to be eligible for arbitration. They cut that to 80%, which isn't much of a drop today, but they also upped the arbitration bonus pool demands back from having come down to $100 million, back up to $115 million, which is where they started on this last fall. Their rationale being, well, we've moved off 100% of the players with 2 years plus, and now we're only asking for 80. So to counter that, we're going to ask for a bigger arbitration pool for awards. So if anything, some ground was lost today. My theory has been all along, Rich, that they would start on time effective today. I don't see any way that happens. I knew we would not start spring training on time. That much has been obvious for anyone, even the casual observer looking at the calendar and seeing how little progress has been made. I believe that they would get something done late in February to get players into camp in the first few days of March, allowing for almost 4 weeks of spring training and an on-time March 31st opening day. I now see that as untenable. So where we go from here, who knows?
Is there an effort on the part of either the commissioner or some owners or both to break the union?
I think they realize that this is the most successful and unified union in North American team sports over the last half century, and that breaking the union is an impossible task. Certainly, you could do that without much effort, it would seem, to the NFL Players Association, which has consistently rolled over for the owners, has never been unified, which is why NFL salaries are still not guaranteed, which is kind of ridiculous, given the amount of money that league churns in revenue every year. The Players Association has a strong history of staying together. Does that mean that there won't be some players unhappy and urging some compromise on their part? No, I could see that happening, but will it weaken the Players Association's efforts and force them to accept a deal that they otherwise wouldn't? No, I don't think so. I think attempting to break the union this far in is a dead end for the owners. But that's not to say they aren't trying to create some pressure points, which, let's face it, are part of nearly any negotiation, especially one as contentious as this one.
We're talking with Sean McAdam here on Downtown. Is there an effort in some way to get what would in effect be a return to a salary cap for the owners?
Well, I mean, as you know, there's never really been a salary cap, and it's one of the things that that owners, I think, even the owners themselves, have given up on trying to attain. It is the third rail for the Players Association, and they've made it clear that they will never agree to it. Now, that said, CBT and the changes that were made last time out 5 years ago, some would tell you, have created a de facto salary cap. It's not called that. It isn't as if you can't go over that cap, but there are quite onerous consequences to doing so, and the owners in their proposals to date, while they have inched up the totals on the threshold, they were having set the threshold, the first threshold, at $210 million in 2021. They initially went to $212 million, and now they've gone up to $214 million. Those are baby steps, obviously. But countering the raising of the threshold is that owners are now proposing that even first-time offenders going over that first threshold would be met with a 50% tax on what is currently a 20% tax. So they've exchanged a tiny kind of cost of living increase to the limit of the threshold from $210 million to $214 million, but they've more than doubled the tax. So that is obviously not acceptable to the Players Association. And I would say that, you know, that lack of movement on the CBT is probably the number one issue here. There's been some back and forth on arbitration and minimum salaries. Those, I think, can be compromised and they can meet in the middle. But if you were to characterize what the players are most intent on getting rid of, it is the de facto soft cap represented by the CBT, and tanking, which they've made some progress on in terms of, allowing instead of the team with the worst record automatically getting the top pick, now there's going to be a lottery. They disagree on how many teams are going to take part. The owners would like three teams in the lottery. The Players Association would like eight. But there's a point to have a middle ground there, whether it be five or six. They can solve that. To me, the outstanding issue here, the one that is probably going to be solved last, is the CBT levels, thresholds, and tax rates.
Sean, what about this proposal from the owners recently to reduce the number of players on what's called the domestic reserve list? Obviously, a cost-saving measure, but is that something that would be good for the health of the game of baseball?
Are you talking about reducing some of the minor league affiliates?
Right,
or...
yes.
I think this is a tough one for the Players Association because they technically do not represent any players not on the 40-man roster. They have to determine how much of a fight they have in this when it is not part of their constituency. I think philosophically, the Players Association would like to see minor league players be treated better, to have better housing, to have more bigger per diems for meal allowance, to have higher minimum salaries, and to the degree that they can be of aid to those looking to go to bat for the minor leaguers, the Players Association has lent some help to them. But I wonder how much time they want to get pulled into the weeds here, essentially fighting a policy that doesn't represent that, for whom they don't represent that constituency. You know, the future of guys at single A and low A are not represented now, though in theory, you know, some of those guys, of course, will one day be part of the Players Association. But it's almost like that's been introduced as somewhat of a distraction for the Players Association, because it's hard for them to work as advocates for players they don't currently represent.
So are we past the point of no return when it comes to being able to start the regular season on time and get in 162 games?
Well, I think we're past starting on March 31st. There just seems too much ground to make up in what would have to be a breakneck pace for, say, the next 2 weeks. They would have to make enormous progress in the next 2 weeks to get players into camp around March 1st or the first few days of March, and then allowing for a four-week, give or take a day or two, spring training and a March 31st start of the regular season. Now, if they were to start on April 6th or 12th, is it conceivable they could find ways to make up? Remember, early in the season, you've got some built-in off days because right. they're cognizant of the potential for cold weather and rain on home openers. So there's always an off day scheduled after your home opener. So you can work around that a little bit. You might have to make up 7, 8, 10 days. I think they could, if they worked hard, they could find a solution to either with double headers or some other mechanism, make those up. I'd say starting on March 31st is basically failed. I'm not ready to give up on 162 games because, you know, they could conceivably start 2 weeks late and figure up a way to make up maybe 10 lost games.
Well, if there is a season, you wrote about this earlier in the week. Nesson is already making some plans and having discussions and some familiar names in the mix to work both in the booth and also to work in the studio for the coming Red Sox season.
With the passing of Jerry Remy last October, obviously there's a big shoes to fill for Nesson. Dennis Eckersley is coming back as the primary analyst, but Eck is at the point of his career and his life where he doesn't want to do many more than half the game. So they have to find a way to give Dave O'Brien a partner or two for about half the schedule. They have talked to Kevin Youkilis, who did some pregame work for them via Zoom last year, and it's my understanding that they're close to a deal with Youkilis. I'm not sure how the workload would be split up and how many games he'd be willing to commit to. He does have a brewery and lives in California, but you know, they could work around that if he were to, they do 40 or so games. And then one of the other names that has popped up is Will Middlebrook, ironically, the guy who kind of supplanted Youkilis on the roster back in 2012. Now it's possible that both may be part of the broadcast team. Middlebrook's deal is not as close to being done as Youkilis's, as I understand it, but he certainly is in contention. He's done a lot of media work the last couple of years, doing some video for CBS Sports and also co-hosting a podcast. So he does have some experience from what I've heard. He's done a good job on camera, seems comfortable in that setting. Of course, his wife is Jenny Dell, the former Nesson sideline reporter, who herself works for CBS Sports these days. So there's always some help being provided by his spouse when it comes to getting acclimated to the TV business. But yeah, it certainly is going to have a different feel and look to the telecast next year, but we knew that with Jerry's recurring bout with cancer and then ultimately, sadly, his passing in last October.
Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal. Sean, we appreciate it as always. Hopefully next time we talk, we can discuss some actual baseball, but thanks so much for helping us make sense of what's going on out there.
My pleasure, Rich. Fingers crossed, and hopefully they can make me look uninformed once again and get this done in the next couple of weeks.
All right, great. We'll talk soon. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Rich.
Sean McAdam with us here on Downtown.